Coming up this week, Trevor Dan hosts our monthly roundtable discussion for February 2019 with topics including Bauer's purchase this week of Lynx FM Group and Celador Radio, and much more as well. James Cridlin will look at whether engineering and IT should be one and the same thing in radio. And David Lloyd has some delightful radio moments.
The Radio Today programme with Broadcast Bionics. Innovative solutions for creative radio people.
But first this week, the spat between the BBC and News UK about a report on 5Live. Trevor has more.
Thank you, Stuart. The report is called Assessing the Delivery of BBC Radio 5 Live's Public Service Commitments. It's a scholarly work and it makes some persuasive points about what it sees as 5 Live's drift away from news and towards chat. But what's made it controversial is that it was funded by News UK, the owners of Talk Radio and TalkSport 1 and 2, who clearly have a commercial interest in its findings. So I've been speaking to Professor Tim Luckhurst, who led the research, but I should say at the outset that he only agreed to speak on the understanding that I declare an interest in that I run an audio production company which is occasionally commissioned by BBC Radio. So perhaps I should also mention that I'm a professor of journalism at Nottingham Trent University, so I have some insight into his world too. First off then, did News UK approach the University of Kent? Or were they asked for funding for a project which was already underway?
News UK approached us to ask whether or not we could devise a methodology to measure whether or not BBC Radio 5 Live was meeting its commitments to Ofcom. What I find surprising is that anybody finds the notion of funded research remotely surprising. Academic research is almost always funded, and indeed, the BBC frequently pays organisations to carry out audience research for it. So, for example, in 2016, it commissioned ICM to carry out a purpose remit survey to see how well it delivered its six public purposes, and the result was largely positive. I really don't recall the BBC accusing ICM of shameless paid-for lobbying, and I was rather surprised to be accused of such a thing by the BBC. This is funded research. That's normal.
But surely Tim Luckhurst isn't surprised by the accusations of, well, they would say that, wouldn't they? He must understand that some people are sceptical. This feels like sugary drinks are good for you, says a report funded by Coca-Cola.
This was commissioned as academic research, and the terms upon which it was commissioned are the University of Kent's standard research contract. What that means, Trevor, as I'm sure you will be well aware, is that News UK surrendered any control over methodology or findings in return for an academically independent research. If they had not done so, the credibility of our results would, of course, have been questionable. But they understood, as do all research funders, that what they are doing is buying academic independence and academic rigour. It's also crucial to understand that the copyright belongs to the four academics who wrote it, not to News UK.
Did the University of Kent approach the BBC for help with this research?
This was based on a data analysis methodology. We didn't speak to anybody in the context of our research. We spent hundreds of hours gathering data, categorising, analysing, evaluating and drawing conclusions. We didn't expect the BBC to be delighted by the outcome, but nor did we expect them to suggest that this was in any way partisan. It is not. It is purely academic work.
I wondered whether Tim Luckhurst, as a former employee of 5 Live, has been taking any pleasure in criticising the station.
We weren't asked the question, has it gone downhill? We were asked the question, does it meet its commitments to Ofcom? And those are that 75% of its outcome during the financial year should be news and current affairs, and that it should provide comprehensive coverage of politics. We found that it does provide comprehensive coverage of politics, but that it doesn't reach the 75% threshold for news and current affairs output. As a former 5 Live launch editor, I was assistant editor at the launch of the station. I won a Sony Award for the station in its first year for response to a news event for the programme I produced covering the IRA ceasefire announcement live from Belfast, and I am a considerable fan of the BBC. Indeed, in recent years, I've been presenting programmes for the BBC in Kent and appearing regularly as an analyst on their output. I am not an enemy of the BBC.
But what is Tim Luckhurst's definition of news? This does seem to be the crucial point. If Andy Murray wins Wimbledon, is that sport or news? Is a conversation with a reporter news or chat? And what about a discussion with a panel of listeners or a caller?
Well, the first point, of course, is much more basic. We define news, and our methodology is absolutely clear about what we regard as news. The BBC does not define news. Indeed, as we point out in our report, this is one of the fundamental problems. The BBC does not have a definition of news. At its best, it simply suggests that news is anything that journalists decide to cover, which is terribly convenient, but not particularly helpful to a regulator. So we've defined news, and we can give examples of things that we say the BBC does on Five Live, which are plainly not news. Let me give you an example from the 22nd of May 2018, when we listened to every second of Up All Night. Between 5 minutes past three and 32 minutes past three in the morning, Up All Night interviewed Luke Barr, author of Ritz and Escoffier, The Hotelier, The Chef, and The Rise of the Leisure Class. There was a very loose peg to the wedding of Harry and Meghan, but this was an extended discussion about luxury accommodation and luxury dining lasting 27 minutes. It's classic talk show fare. Interesting? Certainly. News, not remotely. Not a thing in it was new. On Phil Williams' show on the 22nd of May, for 29 minutes, Five Live broadcast the views of DIY man Tommy Walsh. Now, Tommy Walsh is a great Five Live guest. He combines a love of football and the Rolling Stones with advice on home improvement and repair. Now, that's great. Consumer advice is perhaps a very useful social phenomenon. No questions at all about that. But it isn't news. There is no news content in that programme whatsoever. It's interesting to say that also Five Live itself is making every effort to recruit as presenters people who've never been journalists. So, for example, Nihal Athanayake in the afternoon. He's a very interesting, entertaining presenter, a very successful disc jockey, but he's not a journalist. And Five Live boasts that it's employing as guest presenters the Pussycat Doll, Kimberly Wyatt, Amber Davis of Love Island fame. We suggest that what Five Live is actually doing is broadcasting as a sport and chat station, sport and talk. Now, that's absolutely fine. No problem at all. Perhaps that's what its audience loves. Indeed, there's a great deal of evidence from the Ofcom audience surveys that is indeed what Five Live's audience loves, but it's not what Five Live's license states that it will do.
I must say, some of this reminds me of the early days of GLR, when we were accused of ignoring hard news and had to point out that we were covering important stories in programmes, not just in bulletins. I wonder whether Tim's definition of news is a bit, well, old-fashioned.
Come, Trevor. I'm a biographer of the Today programme, Trevor. I've spent the first 7 years of my career producing current affairs. I've never imagined that the news only takes place in the news bulletin, and that would be a profoundly naive description of our analysis, which is considerably more sophisticated than that suggests. Of course, there is a distinction between news and current affairs, and again, we give that definition absolutely emphatically in our detailed methodology. The point about what we have discovered and what we report and what we stand by absolutely is that Five Live no longer does what it was established to do. And of course, that it probably reflects different audience taste, but it hasn't been reflected in the license upon which Five Live is allowed to broadcast. And Five Live is still saying, the BBC is still saying, that Five Live is a news and sports station. We say, no, in terms of its content, it is a sport and conversation station with a legacy commitment to news. I don't think that's controversial. Listeners don't think so either. In a list of the top 20 sources of news, Five Live doesn't appear. Radio 2 does, Radio 4 does, Facebook does, the Metro newspaper does, but not Five Live. Five Live is a very entertaining sport and conversation station. I'm sure its listeners, many of them, love it for that reason, but that doesn't mean it's fulfilling the terms of its license.
So how does Tim Luckhurst feel about his work being used by News UK for their lobbying purposes?
I am a entirely independent academic, and I believe that the commercial radio sector has every right to represent its interests, as the BBC has to represent its own. I take no sides in that debate. I think that both have legitimate interests and that audiences are best served by a diverse range of services broadcast on radio and on television. As a director of an Ofcom licensed television station myself, I think Ofcom regulation matters, and I think that it's important that the regulator should be able to hold all broadcasters to account on the basis of the commitments they have made in seeking their license. The crucial point here is that there's been a change in the way that the BBC is regulated. One of the reasons we were so determined to undertake this research is that for the first time since its creation as a public corporation in 1927, the BBC is now regulated by Ofcom, not by its own Board of Governors or by the BBC Trust. And we wondered whether Ofcom would have the resources, the methodology, and frankly, the manpower to be able to do such a mammoth task with complete efficiency. We're great fans of Ofcom. We think it's been a very effective regulator. But I think there are some questions about the scale of the task it's taken on in regulating the BBC. And I think that's a question which does deserve to be addressed in future.
And one final thing. Has Tim heard from Jonathan Wall or anyone at Five Live?
I have not heard personally from Jonathan Wall. I have never personally met Jonathan Wall. The University of Kent has received a Freedom of Information request from the BBC asking to look at all correspondence between ourselves and News UK. We'll be absolutely delighted to share it, and they will find it extremely boring.
That's Professor Tim Luckhurst from the Centre for Journalism at the University of Kent. We're at the roundtable at what is now called Margaret Street Studios, and the main tenant is one of our guests. Please introduce yourself.
Hello, I'm Ian McIntosh. I'm the Chief Executive of Muddy Knees Media.
Also here?
I'm Phil Riley, industry veteran, Chief Executive, Chairman of various things over the years.
And I'm Rachel Barton, and I'm owner and CEO of We Are Great.
Welcome, one and all. We've got lots to get through today. We've got the big news about Bauer's new acquisitions breaking as we speak. But I want to start with the Five Live story. What did you think, Phil?
Well, I think there's a great deal of truth in what Tim is saying, that Five Live has moved away from hard news to a mix of news and talk. Realistically, if you want to do 75% news, then you have to actually be a rolling news station. And we know from the history of ITN, when they did rolling news on FM in London many, many years ago, rolling news just isn't that attractive. You've got to add colour and other elements to a radio station to make it something that people want to spend time with. So the reality is you just simply can't fulfil a 75% quota if the quote is going to be interpreted as nothing but news. You have to add colour and light and shade and different things. And that's what they're doing. And that probably just brings into question whether the Ofcom licence is correctly drafted for the world that we live in today and the radio stations that we want to serve us in the UK.
Do you think that the people who did the research should have seen this coming? Were they a bit naive in taking News UK money?
Not really. How else? Think about it from News UK's perspective. They want to start a debate about the future of Five Live and whether it's doing what it's supposed to be doing. How else are they going to achieve that other than by getting somebody that's reasonably well respected and independent to do that research? They can't do it themselves because that would be absolutely shot down. So they've got to go to somebody else to do it. And Tim and the guys at the university took up that challenge. And I've no doubt whatsoever it was done properly and fairly and in the right manner. And so I think the row about that is really secondary to the issues that it raises about the nature of Five Live versus talk and talk sport and whether we've got the right mix between the BBC licensed services and the commercially licensed services.
Ian, do you still consume linear radio?
A little here and there, and Five Live's football coverage is unsurpassed, and that's been, as an ex-football journalist of 10 years, one of the nice things is being able to listen to football on the radio again. They're wonderful at that. However, I listened to that station pretty much since the mid-90s rebrand up until about 2 years ago, and I stopped listening to all the other shows because I'm very much the anti-Michael Gove. I like experts. I like being told stuff by people who know things. And there seemed to be this kind of slide into multiple vox pops, particularly about Brexit, which is this kind of self-perpetuating circle of not knowing anything. I don't want to paraphrase Sid Vicious on such a respectable show, but I've met the man in the street. There's a street outside my house. If I want that view, I'll go get it myself. So, no, I had a lot of sympathy with the report. And in all honesty, I've gravitated towards other forms of media, particularly The Economist's range of podcasts, which are experts telling me stuff I don't know.
Rachel, part of what Radio 5 Live has tried to do over the past maybe decade has been to try to get more women and more young people. Grape, your company, works in that kind of marketplace. Do you get the feeling that they've got that right? Is that a sensible strategy?
I think that they are certainly making steps to do so. I would describe myself as a casual Five Live listener, but I was talking this morning with one of my team who's an avid Five Live listener. He's really into music and, you know, he's 25 and he's massively into sport and he listens religiously. And we were talking this morning about how a lot of their news items do seem to be aimed at a kind of a much younger generation. I think most recently, what stuck in my mind, they talked about the Fire Festival documentary, which is on at Netflix at the moment, which
great.
Obviously is a huge...
Watched it last night.
Oh, yeah.
What a great,
fantastic
documentary.
And it's a huge talking point amongst all ages, but particularly amongst kind of that younger generation. So I feel like it's, you know, it's very clear they're making those steps. I do agree they've got an incredibly hard remit to try and kind of cover all news to all people. And I think it probably was a sensible move to try and kind of focus on a certain area.
I think the challenge is doing linear radio when you're not in a niche. If you're trying to say, oh, first for news and the best live sport, you've already got a problem.
I think you have to be careful what you wish for in the case of talk radio, talk sport, because if Five Live were told by Ofcom or the weight of public opinion that this mix of news and sport simply couldn't be sustained and they had to do something about it. If Five Live turned around and said, well, then Five Live Sports Extra will become 24-hour sport and Five Live will become 24-hour news and talk, that would probably not be good for talk radio and talk sport. At the moment, they're facing a single competitor that has to balance both things. So there's just a bit of a risk there that they end up tipping up the apple cart and what comes out at the end might be even worse than the competitor they face today.
I'm not just asking this because I've got Ian here, but I'm increasingly feeling that what Radio 5 is for is live sport, because it's the only thing that podcasting can't do by definition. And if I want to hear comment or analysis, I'm going somewhere else, I think.
I think that can happen, though. It should be said that when they do that, they can do it very, very well. The Monday Night Club with Mark Chapman is a brilliant piece of radio. And you have things like John Pienaar's show on a Sunday morning.
Sunday Politics, yeah. Pienaar's Politics.
That's the one. That's a really good listen. But it is difficult because you start to get outflanked by smaller, more dynamic companies who can follow niches down rabbit holes.
One interesting thing I wanted to ask Ian was, clearly your focus is on football. And Five Live obviously are big on football. I've noticed, being more of a rugby fan, that if you look at the podcast charts, many of the top podcasts in those charts are rugby. I mean, there are some footballs, yours is one of them, but rugby does disproportionately well in those charts. And I think it's because if you're a rugby fan, there's nowhere to go on live radio really to get that instant analysis and debate and comment about the sport other than on podcasts, because Five Live do rugby, but it's, I don't know, it's tucked away on a Wednesday or a Thursday night.
Rachel, can I ask you about this? Maybe now's as good a time as any to talk about BBC Sounds, which is absolutely hell for leather going for under 35-year-olds. And they are the people we're told are turning their back on linear radio and doing exactly what Phil's just talked about and finding the particular niche that they want and having no patience to wait through something they're not interested in. Is that changing the nature of your business?
I mean, I think as programme makers, we're all just trying to make the best we can in terms. And I think that absolutely, yes, we are thinking, when particularly for our weekly programmes for Radio 1, we're really making sure that things happen regularly throughout the programme. There are long music sweeps, for example, whereas maybe 10 years ago we would have had the time and the feeling that we should let music really, really breathe. And there's a time and a place for that, absolutely. But I think within a lot of our programming, we're just making sure that the things are tightly edited. We move on quite quickly. So, yeah, I think there is a factor of that.
And is that, sorry to interrupt, but is that because of the famous they haven't got any attention span, or is it because you want to be able to cut stuff up and make it shareable?
I think a bit of both, to be honest. I mean, I think our company really targets the kind of the youth market, and particularly within the dance spectrum. And so, you know, people do go to clubs and they go there for 12 hours and they listen to a DJ and stuff. And so the people, you know, young people do have long attention spans in the right circumstances. But I think it's, yeah, within radio, it's about kind of keeping things, you know, appropriate for the time slot and for kind of the audience who's listening at that time.
I met James Purnell this week at an Audio UK audience with, and he was telling us how successful BBC Sounds is. The new way that you discuss it is you say, well, we launched it before it was ready, but that's kind of what you do in that space, he said. So are any of us ready for BBC Sounds?
I don't use it myself, and fortunately it is on my podcast list, but it's disappeared. And I'm sorry, I use Pocket Casts, and that's the thing that I default to. And if I'm walking along the street and one podcast ends and I want to get another one, I'm going to go to something that's on my Pocket Cast list. I'm not going to faff about changing apps in the middle of a tube journey or on a street. And I think for me, that degree of ring fencing and walled garden, I just think that's absolutely terrible.
Isn't it a bit like awful saying to us all as consumers, you know that television you've got, which currently gets all sorts of different products, you're now going to have a special one just for the BBC. Can you put that just to the right there and flick over for our shows?
It's crazy. And I just don't know what they hope they will achieve by it. The BBC are always going to be a player in these markets. They're always going to do great, make great content. Why do they feel the need to have some sort of walled garden for it? I just don't get it.
Ian, do you get it?
Well, I realise that as, you know, owner of a plucky little podcast startup, it should be my role to lay into the BBC at this stage. And I certainly do have concerns. But I think a lot of us in the independent side are looking at this as a kind of rising tide, hopefully lifting all of our boats. And first album I ever bought was Michael Jackson's Bad album in Asda in 1985. But I didn't only listen to Michael Jackson, and I didn't only buy music from Asda because I was seven. I went on and I found new stuff. And I think we're all hoping that what the BBC can do with this is overcome the biggest obstacle that we all have as podcast makers, which is that a massive proportion of the country seems to think that podcasts are difficult to get, and there's this obstacle of, well, I've heard a lot about them, but how do I make them work? And they don't realise it's like three buttons on your phone and everybody's got a phone. So I'm hoping that the BBC can help us all kind of get over that hurdle, educate people on how to use podcasts, lay down their own wares, and then people will do what I did with music in 1985 and go elsewhere.
No, it's a noble vision. Rachel, is it working, do you think? Are you hearing from your customers that BBC Sounds is a thing that they must have?
I think it's still making, you know, making steps to get that traction. I think that will kind of take a little bit of time. One thing I would say that's actually really great about it is that I think it actually looks good. I had a meeting with Spotify last week and we were talking about this, and they actually really complimented on the actual overall look of the app, and actually the kind of consistency across the kind of you know, using the press shots for, you know, BBC programmes, etc., with the kind of interesting graphics, etc., and the colourways they've used. So I think that's a really important thing for us. Certainly when we're making content, it's all very well if it's sounding obviously as great as we can make it, but actually, particularly, you know, on certain different platforms, we need to think about how it looks as well, so it's kind of eye-catching and kind of reaching the audience that might not be kind of informed and are just scrolling. So
you mentioned Spotify, and we'll talk about their activities shortly. Mm-hmm. They're making a big push in the direction of buying in programme ideas now, aren't they?
They certainly are. It's a really interesting time, and I think, well, they said to me last week that podcasts are their number one global priority for 2019, and I think that's shown by kind of news that's been kind of cropping up this week, etc. So I think it's their vision is to kind of be the global hub for podcasts, which, because at the moment it is quite fractured, isn't it? You know, there's various different places to kind of consume podcasts. So I think it would be interesting to see whether they can make that step and kind of become the official home. Whether that's
interesting,
possible.
Just I think following up what you were saying, Phil, about the walled garden and the BBC's approach. I'm wondering if they've got it at 180 degrees wrong. And in a sense, what they should be doing is putting all their podcasts onto Spotify rather than building their own platform.
Yeah, but many young people are using YouTube for podcasts, aren't they, as well? Mm. I think young people just go and find them wherever they are. Older people, I think, is more where there's an issue. Which device am I supposed to press? Interestingly, just a codicil about... got my Brexit mentioned in there.
Very good.
About young people's attention span. My daughter said to me over dinner the other day that she doesn't listen to radio anymore. She's now firmly into podcasting. And she named up one podcast for me to go and listen to. This podcast is 2 hours, 45 minutes long. So You can't tell me that young people don't have an attention span.
So what we were talking about in the commercial world, Ian, is that Spotify have bid for Gimlet Media. This is a very big deal if it goes through. What do you make of that? It's got to be good news in your sector, hasn't it?
I think so, yeah. I mean, we know Gimlet very well. We worked with them on the We Came to Win football documentaries they did before the World Cup. I was in Brooklyn at the end of last year going around their incredible offices, 27 of their own studios. They've got a room. When they want theme tunes, they bring in musicians and they record them in a separate music studio, and they're everything that everyone in this industry wants to be. And for Spotify,
we're all crying.
To come in
that's
like
why
that.
There's no noise. Off.
But, but this is, I think, it may have been last time I was on this show. I think I was banging on about it. There is a massive consolidation coming in this industry right now. There are too many podcasts. There are quite possibly more podcasts than there are podcast listeners. And if it was an urban landscape, it would be a handful of skyscrapers and miles and miles and miles of bungalows.
Or shanties.
Yeah.
Or shanties, yeah.
So there is going to be a consolidation. It's not unlike the football blogging scene of about 2009, when suddenly every man under the age of 40 and quite a few women had their own football blog. And what happened over the course of about 5 years is that the really good writers ended up getting picked up and getting jobs at The Guardian and things like that. And then gradually kind of real life set in and people started getting married and having kids. And suddenly the whole thing that everyone had been doing dried up. And I think somewhere down the line, there's going to be this contraction in the podcast market because they're not all making money. You know, we've been very fortunate and we've worked very hard with the Totally Football Show and we're profitable and that's wonderful. But there's a lot of shows that are spending a lot of money on marketing and they're getting very small audiences. And we're now just getting to a point where I think big business is realising they can snap up the profitable ones for actually not that much money.
Before Phil uses another codicil, we've reached the backstop on this particular section. We'll take some advertisements, then we'll come back and talk about the big industry news of the week.
Yeah, let's just pause from the discussion for a moment to tell you about Clean Feed, if you've not heard about it. It's great for doing OBs for your radio show, or perhaps interviews, or co-hosting from a remote location for a podcast. Clean Feed has been designed for people in radio and for podcasters as well, and it's really simple to connect in live studio quality audio over the web just using your browser. As I say, the quality is great. You can even record right within the web browser as well, and it won't cost you anything to get started. There is a free trial version. It only takes you 30 seconds to sign up, and within minutes you'll be doing your first live interview or recording something for your show or your podcast. Find out more at cleanfeed.net. Back to you, Trevor.
Phil Riley is here. Ian McIntosh is here. Rachel Barton is here. We're talking about the month in radio. This is the Radio Today Roundtable for February. And the news that has been breaking while we've been getting ready is that Bauer have bought yet more radio stations. They've bought the Lynx FM group and they bought the Celador group. Phil, you can't talk about this because until last week you were non-exec director of Celador.
But that's correct, yeah.
I think you could talk about whether you see this as just the latest step on an inevitable consolidation into basically three radio groups in the UK.
Yeah, first of all, I want to say good luck to all the Celador guys. I think they've, I hope, landed in a good place because Bauer are a great company and they have a passionate belief in local radio. And I think it's always difficult for smaller groups to fight their corner against the big guys in local markets. And the great news for the Celador guys is they're no longer the small guy going up against the bigger guy. They're part of a
You
bigger
say
team.
That, Phil, but I'm going to say lots of them won't have a job at all, will they?
Well, I don't... Who knows where the...
Let's end, guess. Well, on the basis of past performance.
Well, I think that's slightly unfair because Bauer Well, certainly in the case of Orion, when they purchased Orion. I mean, although, you know, some roles will have gone, some people will have moved on. Actually, the turnover in radio is pretty high anyway. People move all the time for new jobs. So I don't personally think that we should get too worried about some of the roles that will be lost in a consolidation, because actually those roles may have been lost anyway. The consolidation is coming due to radio industry rule changes. Also, hats off to Paul Smith, who I don't think has really got the credit in the radio industry he should have, for as a guy who came in 11 years ago, used his own money to buy and build a radio group that's, you know, now done something very good in terms of being picked up by Bauer. But he did that all off his own bat, and he did that out of a real passion for radio that was unrequited for a long time. I mean, I was a partner of Paul's in 1993 when we bid for one of the London FM licenses. I think it was the one that X may have won. We bid with a rock format. I was a brown envelope at the time, and I've been friends with him ever since. So he's had a passion for radio for a long time. He's now done what he set out to do, which is to build a radio group. He sold it, and I think he's done that probably at the right time. I think it's the right time for consolidation at that level. And I'm sure he's got, well, I know he's got some very interesting things to do with his other media and entertainment interests. So good luck to him going forward. As far as the more general picture is concerned, I think it is inevitable. It's difficult to imagine that small-scale radio stations can survive, given the squeeze that the big two, Bauer and Global, have got on the national marketplace. A national income is the thing that will make the difference for many stations between being profitable or just keeping their head above water. And therefore, as that squeeze gets tighter and tighter, the difficulty with the smaller stations is, can they just survive on local sales? That's tough. You do need that national, the cream of the national revenue to take you over the top and make you profitable. And I think that's why the consolidation, I think, is inevitable.
It's a good job I didn't ask you a question that you could talk about.
Yeah.
I just want to take a moment to recommend to everybody listening to this that they follow you on Twitter, because in the past few months, you've started divulging information about...
Not about this deal.
But about how much radio stations are worth, how much a listener is worth, how much a digital listener is worth compared to an analogue listener, and all that kind of stuff. And you've been very open about this. And I've started copying all your tweets and pasting them into a folder called Stuff I Can Pass Off As My Own Opinion.
Thank you. But it's the niche I seem to have found for myself.
Very impressive, Phil. Let's go to Rachel. What do you make of this consolidation that seems to be unstoppable?
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating to watch. I mean, I cannot remember a period in radio like the last few months, really. It's just been so much going on, both the BBC national networks and, of course, Bauer and et cetera, and Global. And I mean, I think that's fantastic for the industry to be kind of lots going on. I mean, Bauer are on fire as well with the kind of the launch of Scala next month, I believe, isn't it?
It is, beginning of next month, yeah.
So, and that I'm really curious as to kind of exactly how that's going to be and stuff. So, just a really exciting time.
And will your company be offering programmes to Bauer, who are the first people to show their face as wanting programmes from the Audio Content Fund?
Yeah, I had a really great chat with Paul Sylvester a couple of weeks ago, and he's a really great guy and has got some really good vision. So yeah, we'll absolutely be looking at some programme ideas for them. It'd be a really interesting thing to do.
And what's the rationale? I'm going to come back to you, Phil, before we go to Ian. What's the rationale from a Bauer or Global point of view, or a Wireless News UK point of view, of spending a lot of money on a tiny digital station like a Scala or a Virgin? What do they hope that will give them?
Size and scale. If you look at the numbers now for Global versus Bauer, Bauer are still behind Global, although they've closed the gap today. They've bought themselves a lot of listeners and a lot of listening hours, and they've closed that gap. But they're still some way behind. And in the national marketplace, the number one player gets a premium for their spots versus the number two player. And so the closer that gap gets, the less of a premium number one gets over number two, or the less of a discount number two has to suffer. So it's all about trading size and scale. And clearly, there are only so many local stations you can buy, and we're probably close to the end of that, realistically. So for Bauer to make any further headroom, and I think the gap's 40, 50 million hours between them, depending on which sort of metric you use. Well, they've got to do something new, haven't they? So Scarlett is their play, and obviously it's a clever play, because if they can get 10 million hours for Scarlett and at the same time nick 5 million of those from Classic, they've closed that gap by 15 million hours, and that's part of their play, I'm sure.
Ian, then, from your perspective, from the podcast sector's perspective, is this the last sort of dying twitch of linear radio before everybody falls into your bag?
No. No, I don't think that.
I didn't think it was.
Yeah, as I grew up, radio, always been more radio than TV. I sincerely hope that that would never be the case. There will always be multiple things that radio can do that podcasts can't. And I hope we live in harmony for some time yet.
So where are we now then in terms of the other things that are going on? Have we got a word about Zoe and Chris and Sarah Cox and some of the and Lauren and some of the other new shows that have launched?
Early, I'd say too early to say. I've heard from insiders inside news that they're getting some very, very interesting traction, particularly online traction. Numbers of online listeners have rocketed. But I also think it's a bit of a challenge, isn't it? Because it's on the second digital multiplex, which isn't available everywhere. People have got to retune their digital radio. So there's a few hurdles to go. So it might be a slow build.
I think of all the kind of, certainly the BBC shows that have launched, like Sarah is feeling really comfortable already. I feel like she's kind of in that natural time slot. It's perfect for her and seems, yeah, just it really feels like she's kind of found her niche within Radio 2. Zoe, I think, is a much harder kind of task, really. I mean, that breakfast show is so iconic, and the likes of Wogan and then obviously Chris Evans, who's an amazing broadcaster. I think that will take her time to kind of find her true voice, and I think we should give her that time. What I've heard so far I really like, but, you know, inevitably a breakfast show, it can take time to kind of really, you know, to finally get that voice and your kind of USP. And I mean, in terms of Six Music, I mean, Lauren Laverne's an amazing broadcaster. I was listening to her this morning, actually, and it made me think she's actually a really different type of breakfast show presenter, because she's quite her style is she's quite measured and she's quite quiet. And, you know, although she's got a great charm and sense of humour, it's not the kind of all, you know, be all shouting kind of, you know, energy to
which
to start
is a
the day,
relief, isn't
which
it?
Which is a relief, and I think it's so appropriate for Six Music, and I think that's what the Six Music listeners will really enjoy. So, I mean, change is fantastic, and I just think what's amazing as well as you know, I'm obviously a huge advocate for women in this industry, and I think that to have, you know, four women with Marianne as well on, you know, daytime Six Music, daytime Radio 2 with Sarah and with Zoe, and of course Lauren on Six as well, I think is fantastic. But most importantly, they're talented broadcasters. You know, it's not just the fact that they're women and they're there for, you know, for that, you know, for that reason, they're there for being, in fact, you know, fantastic, and I think that's amazing for our industry.
The other issue that's emerged in the last couple of weeks, led by Tony Blackburn and John Myers, is this observation, and it's nothing new, that nobody really wants old listeners. And by old, we're now increasingly meaning over 50. There are a lot of, dare I say, us out there, and I'm feeling a little less franchised than I was by Radio 2 and 5 Live, even Radio 4 sometimes. Is that just inevitable, because the BBC will chase commercial radio and commercial radio will chase where the ads are?
Thanks for looking at me, Trevor. I, fellow.
You were the only person who was making eye contact with me.
First of all, I think I would probably dispute John and Tony's view that older people are somehow dissatisfied with radio or not being served. There are plenty of older people listening to a lot of radio, so there must be something on there that they're enjoying. And Radio 2, I think, is doing a pretty good job. There was an article in The Express that I know you circulated. I'd read it independently, which was quite ridiculous in its approach, which said...
In The Express, and it was ridiculous.
Saying that somehow the old people were being underserved because we weren't getting The Organist entertained anymore.
Oh, I know.
I mean, for goodness sake. the people that... You know, my mum and dad liked The Organist entertained. They're dead, my mum and dad. I love them dearly, and I had to listen to Radio 2 a lot when they were, you know, in charge of the radio. But that era has gone. Is Radio 2 super serving people who are over the age of 70? Possibly not. Possibly it's pitched at a 45 to 59-year-old pure audience. Do people over the age of 60 necessarily want to go to their local radio station, their BBC local radio station? I'm not sure that they do.
So you say not anymore.
You could argue that there was a gap, perhaps, for a station aimed at people who are over the age of 65. But the challenge is they consume so much other media, you can't make any money out of serving them. So from a commercial perspective, it's very difficult to make the numbers work, because you can get to a lot of old people very inexpensively on daytime television, which is why you see all the ads for. So it just isn't the money there to support a commercial venture. And the BBC can only do so many things with its frequencies.
Because I was, as you know, I listen to your podcasts, Ian.
And thank you very much.
You tend not to have 60, 65-year-old people contributing. I mean, you'll tell me that I'm wrong here, but I'm not hearing Richard Williams on your podcast. I'm not hearing Paddy Barclay. I'm not hearing that generation, because I assume you think that their demographic is too old. Would that be right?
It's not so much that. It's that the Totally Football shows have a certain voice of a certain generation, and the audience is backed up. 77% of our audience, I think, is 25 to 44. So generally our panels reflect that. Also, the names that you've just mentioned are frequently on TalkSport and Sky Sports and things like that. So it's not that we've been able to sort of assess a gap in the market for the more experienced reporter. And in essence, what we do gets a big audience. So we'll keep doing it for now and gradually add younger ones. But just one point on older listeners. I don't think older people are that old anymore. You know, Led Zeppelin
Thank
are
you.
In their early 70s.
That's the nicest thing you've ever said.
I think you have an idea of what old people should be listening to, and then you realise that I think that that's changed quite dramatically. I'm not sure there's that much dissatisfaction out there.
Interestingly, though, Greatest Hits Radio, which I know partly comes from this very studio complex, has got some real resonance. Well, we had some friends come round for dinner the other night and from Birmingham, and so true blue Brummies, and of course Greatest Hits Radio is available on FM in that market, and they were raving about it in a way that I can't recall them raving about any radio station I've been involved with. These are old friends of mine. And I thought, okay, that the Greatest Hits Radio guys have found a particular niche there in terms of oldies on FM / DAB, but I think it's on FM with these people that's really resonated with them. And I think there maybe is something in that, that there is a gap there, that there hasn't been a station super serving a 55 to 69-year-old audience, people that maybe like 60s and 70s music.
It's really interesting that, because we've had it on in the office, because Mark Goodyear comes in every morning and he does his show from here, so we sort of turned it on, and we didn't turn it off. It was quite nice just to have... And I don't mean to sort of diminish it by saying it was just uncomplicated radio. It was in excess, followed by Madonna, followed by the Beatles. It was just nice background stuff.
Good. That in America, these greatest hits, the WCBSs, have been stalwart radio stations getting great ratings forever and ever. What we've never done in the UK is have an up-tempo oldie station on FM, so it's widely available to everybody, whether they're in a corner shop or in their car, etc. I know we've had oldie stations on DAB, but we've not had one on the still universal platform, and it seems to have made a difference.
We'll be back in a tick and find out what our stellar panellists have been listening to.
Broadcast Bionics brings you Phone Box, Oasis, Virtual Director, and many more innovative solutions for creative radio people. Come to bionics.co.uk and find out more.
Ian McIntosh from Muddy Knees, Phil Riley from, just pretty much everything. Can I call you Heritage?
Yeah. Veteran. I don't mind veteran.
But let's go to somebody at
younger,
the cutting edge.
More attractive, yeah.
Steady. Rachel Barton, so what have you been listening to?
Well, I am first of all going to talk about podcasts, which I've been listening to, which Ian, you may well be familiar with. I think it's been around for a little while, but it's called Dissect, and it's a music podcast, and it's quite it's a very interesting kind of way of doing it. They basically each season or series they profile one album, and in each episode they dissect a track from that album. And in our fast paced, like we were talking about earlier, our fast paced world where everything's really, really quick and etc., it's actually lovely to kind of have the space and the time to really look at a single track and actually kind of look at the samples used, what the lyrics mean, the musicality within it. And it's really well put together. So series one was about Kendrick Lamar, series two was Kanye West, series three was Frank Ocean, and series four is Lauryn Hill and Miss Education. So they're starting to kind of be a bit retrospective and look at classic albums, and I just really like it. It's incredibly in depth and detailed, dare I say perhaps too serious at times. We could do with a little bit of the fun element coming into it, but I highly recommend it for those kind of really in depth music fans.
Here's a clip.
The track begins with a drum pattern created from samples taken from a 1987 Boogie Down production song called Super Ho. The bass drum, snare, and hi-hat are then used to create the drum pattern carried throughout Lost Ones. In addition to the boom-bat drums, we hear scratching turntables used as rhythmic accents.
Just before we leave Dissect, there's a bit of a nerdy question. Right issues here with lots of music? I mean, people are always saying, oh, am I allowed to use clips in podcasts?
It's such a good point. And I would love, if there was one thing I wish we could sort out the music rights in podcasting, because, I mean, surely in 2019, there must be a way of fixing this, because there isn't a kind of simple way of doing things. I think the way this particular podcast works is creative license. So their clips are up to 30 seconds. And I presume because they're obviously, you know, looking at one album so in depth over kind of a series of episodes, or a full series I should say, that particular artist has gone, okay, it's fine. But yeah, I mean, let's try and, can we please sort this out?
What we need is a lawyer to
we
be
do.
Listening. Paul March, are you listening?
Well, you know, I wonder if the solution might be Spotify's sudden bid for world domination.
Uh-huh.
They've already got the licenses. Ba-ba-ba. Does that mean that Gimlet Media, will there be some kind of transference there?
I did read something this morning where somebody very expert, James Cridland, I think it was, said that Spotify's license might not allow them to edit tracks, and therefore that might be a challenge. But I don't know. I'm just second quoting James, who's
back to Rachel
very good in
it. Yeah, absolutely. Back to Rachel in the tick. Ian, what's your first choice?
I've been really enjoying. I alluded to The Economist earlier, whose podcast I've always liked, particularly the Anne McElvoy ones, because she's brilliant. But they've just launched The Intelligence, their new daily kind of current affairs show, which is great on the way home from work, I've found, because it's a much sort of slower pace, a kind of reflection, a more magazine featurey kind of look at present day issues. And it's really well produced. The voiceover's fantastic. It's, yeah, you can tell how much work and how much manpower's gone into it.
And I know this is a simplistic point, but isn't one of the great things about it and the New York Daily and all those kind of things that they don't have all that radio furniture in them? They don't have travel and weather. And
yeah.
Fred, I've got to hurry you. There's a bulletin on its way. It's just the fact that it's as long as it needs to be.
And
it's
also,
very
to go back to what I was saying about Five Live, that everyone who speaks on it is their expert. You know, here's something that's happening in Venezuela. Here's our person who lives in Venezuela and has been on this story for years. And here's what they think.
The Economist. Sounds like this.
After a volatile 2 weeks in Venezuela, demonstrations against the president erupted once more this weekend. But Nicolas Maduro gave a defiant speech at a rally, insisting he would remain in power.
Este muchacho, este obrero, este hombre de a pie, Nicolás Maduro Moro, es la verdad.
That's despite the fact that he's no longer recognized as president by America and a number of other countries.
Well, we've had, yet again, millions of people out on the streets in Venezuela protesting against the illegitimate rule of Nicolas Maduro.
Robert Guest is The Economist.
That's The Economist. Phil, one from you.
Yeah, I'm going to pick Ian Dale and Jackie Smith's For the Many podcast, which is in fact, it is probably my favourite podcast. It's the one I look forward to the most popping into my...
You must know Jackie Smith. She lives near you.
She lives in Malvern, but was the MP for Redditch. Ian, I know from long ago. Their podcast is a mix of great insight into the current politics of the UK, mixed with absolute smut. I mean, it's the perfect example of why podcasts are different to radio, linear radio, licensed radio, because you could just never get away with the smut they get away with if you were broadcasting. And that does provide some great light and shade. And this week's was particularly smutty. They'll be particularly pleased I've probably said that about them.
Let's have a clip.
We're walking in the air. I thought we'd start on a high note, if you get my drift.
You're too high from the sound of it.
Well, I've emulated Bubba and been de-bollocked this week, so I thought I could sing that. Bubba's my dog, in case people don't know that.
I was at a fantastic concert last night of sort of Baroque music, and one of the singers was a countertenor who had the most amazing, you know, high voice, but absolutely beautiful. I think he'd still got all his bits, but...
Did you say, come here, young man?
Let me just check.
Let me just cop a feel. As you do.
So that's Ian Dale and Jackie Smith. On the subject of smut, my friends at Folder & Co. have been making the new podcast for Radio 1, in which the BBC has officially sanctioned the use of the C-bomb on a couple of occasions. This is the podcast called Worst Date. Nothing to do with me. Let's go back to Rachel, your second one, please.
Yeah, so is it incredibly crass of me to talk about a production by my company? I'm not sure, is that okay?
You wouldn't be the first person on this podcast to do it.
I didn't think I would be. But
let me just change my notes.
But the reason I picked it is actually I'm a huge fan of the actual series. So on the World Service there's a series called In the Studio, which is basically all about kind of creative leaders from every single walk of life. From they've had composers, they've had DJs, they've had underwater sculptors. I listened to an episode the other day, but so it's a really great series. I highly recommend it. And we've made various different programs for them. But the one I wanted to talk about is basically focusing on Virgil Abloh, who is this incredible guy. He's a kind of DJ, a music maker. He's Louis Vuitton's chief designer, and he's also collaborated with IKEA on a furniture range. So basically, we followed him as to how he kind of goes about his life, his incredibly crazy creative life, and just kind of get a sense of, you know, how he does it and what his thinking is. And he's just one of these people where you're just like, I can see why you do the job you do, because his thinking is so left of centre, so kind of crazy and brilliantly unique. So it was a really great programme to make.
Let's have a listen to a little piece of that.
Here he is with Henrik Most, the IKEA creative lead, in early 2018, 2 years into the process. They're talking about how to make the chair they're designing look good and feel good.
An edge. Then the edge will actually.
Yeah, yeah, you will have it on your bum.
In your bum. Yeah. So that is then, the question if it's possible to smoothen that out a bit.
I think it's key that it reads.
Whilst, of course, Virgil is an experienced collaborator, this project is something new for him. I wanted to know what motivated him to work with a global furniture brand.
It's like I like the conundrum that furniture isn't in pop culture, and that sort of feeds into the why. Why does this chair exist? Mm. How do you notice design? You usually only notice design when something's broke.
Thanks for that, Rachel. Ian, another one from you.
Classic FM's new podcast by David Walliams, which is aimed at a very much a younger audience. The first episode came out this week and is about Mozart, and is mainly 15 minutes of fart jokes and clips and funny stories.
Young people today.
And silly voices and all the things that David Walliams does very well. I really enjoyed it, and I would definitely play that to my seven-year-old. And I think it's a really interesting line as well, very much in keeping with Scala's sudden emergence, bringing classical music to a new audience. I think it's a really interesting thing to do as well.
So here's what the young Macintosh will be listening on his journey towards Scala.
Yep, Mozart was very smart. He was also obsessed with childish fart jokes. Fart!
Before we continue with the concert, I would like to invite our clarinetist to pull my finger.
Oh, Mozart, I really don't want to do this.
Go on, it'll be funny.
I know exactly what you're trying to do. You're not going to get me this time.
It's not the joke you're thinking of.
Fine, just so we can get on with the concert, I'll pull your finger. Here I go. Ugh, gross.
It was the joke you're thinking of.
Thank you for that one, Ian. A final choice from you, Phil.
Yeah, honourable mention to Brexitcast for the sheer number of podcasts that they're managing to get through, given the political situation. Actually, I'm going to pick one on rugby. I know Ian's sitting next to me with great football. I'm going to pick the Sunday Times Ruck podcast, because it's one of the examples, I think, of where podcasting has allowed people who are knowledgeable and expert in one particular medium on a subject to expand that into something else. And Stephen Jones, who's the Sunday Times chief rugby correspondent, is a very great writer about rugby, But actually on the podcast, he's a very funny guy. He's got a really well-turned sense of humour. He can take the mickey out of the fellow contributors, but you can tell they all like him for doing it. And actually, he's, in my mind, he's growing because he's being allowed to do something in podcasting that he's not necessarily allowed to do so much in the newspaper.
This is really a quiz question. Here's the quote. The Dublin game had about 12 minutes of rugby worth watching. The rest of the game was about as much fun to watch as a censorious dentist unimpressed with your dental hygiene. So which nation's media contributed that, do we think?
Would it be a nation, for instance, that's now completely panicking and hates the idea of England being any good? And even then, it's utterly pathetic.
I think you're close to the mark there, yeah, getting warmer.
I assume it's a New Zealand journalist and not a member of the New Zealand coaching panel.
No, it is a Kiwi journalist. And yes, I suppose that's very predictable. I think your point, Steve, is probably anyone would have watched that and gone, shit.
Can I just put to all of you, in last week's podcast, I was at the Gillard Awards, the local radio awards, and I talked to Kat and Jenny, who do the Naked podcast at Radio Sheffield. And I asked them whether they thought that doing a podcast had made them into different broadcasters. And there was a short gap. And then they both said, you know what it has? It's really made us think about the way we speak on the wireless, because we are that little bit less formal, that little bit less, oh, we're on the BBC and it's all kind of constrained, and a little bit more relaxed. And I just wonder if the three of you have noticed that kind of thing slipping into some of the broadcasting that we hear.
I've not noticed it so much in broadcasting, because I have to be honest, most of my listening now is podcasting. Because something you said earlier, the furniture gets in the way for me. I could just do without the furniture, and you get that with podcasts.
I was just thinking about that. I love the excitement of a rolling news broadcast, but podcasts do give you that opportunity to build a greater sense of intimacy, to know that the people that you're talking to are people like you. You know, we do. I'm sitting here in front of a Galazzo Italian football show microphone here. So, you know, when James Richardson's presenting that, he knows that everybody is a very niche sort of football fan. So it's quite nice.
Yeah, I think I agree with Ian. I think, you know, podcasting in general, it makes you very focused to your kind of your audience about that particular subject, about that particular area. Whereas I suppose broadcasters, most of the time, can be that bit broader. So perhaps I think it's a really interesting point to think on. I'm going to dwell on that for sure.
Rachel Barton, Ian McIntosh, Phil Riley, thank you for being a stellar panel for the Radio Today Roundtable for February. We'll be back in a month's time. And we'd like to thank Margaret Street Studios, as they're now called, for hosting us today. Back to you, Stu.
Thank you, Trevor, and to guests Rachel, Ian and Phil. David Lloyd still to come after we talk tech.
I'm James Cridland, the radio futurologist.
Challenge and creativity. From one flows the other. From the present to the future.
In 2007, I started working for the BBC in London in something then known as Future Media and Technology. And as soon as I was started, I was told of a split within the organisation's technology teams that I should be aware of. There were, in essence, two different technology teams, known as Big T and Little T. Big T was technology with a capital T, the sort of technology that costs lots of money. Transmitters, studio equipment, radio cars, cameras, CD players, all that sort of thing. Big T was an integral part of the BBC. The largest office when Broadcasting House was built was the chief engineers, so I was told, not the director generals. And when pressed after a few beers, the Big T people would all agree that really the BBC was a broadcast engineering company with some programme makers using their nice equipment. Little T was technology with a small t, the sort of technology like laptops, websites, webcams, Perl scripts, email systems and all that. Anything involved with the web particularly was little t. And this split used to be relatively common in many radio stations and radio groups. And it's the sort of split that becomes quite difficult to deal with for people in the intersection of the two.
Where change once moved as the hour hand on a clock, now it rockets at a speed the mind's eye can hardly follow.
Big T has big budgets, big responsibilities, and very long lead times. It speaks the language of broadcast redundancy and of caution. Little T has smaller budgets, but is required often to move at internet speed. Often it can't do a job to the same resiliency as Big T, so there's a real clash here sometimes. Is running the streaming infrastructure for your radio station the job of IT or engineering? It's audio and connects to Big T, so it's engineering perhaps, but it's computers and interfaces with the consumer internet, so it's also little t. Who ends up doing that? You want to get audio files off the playout system, Big T, and then encode them and upload them to an audio server, Little T. You want to check which studio is on air, Big T, to switch the webcam feed for the website, Little T. Then there are those parts of broadcast infrastructure where Little T and Big T intersect as well. What data goes onto an RDS encoder or the DAB DLS? Engineering was once a complex world of soldering irons and replacing pinch wheels on cart machines and complex wiring looms, DAT machines and much more. But increasingly, a studio is a set of computers linked together and minimal other equipment, certainly unlikely to be user serviceable. Engineering in many ways is now mainly an in-house specialist IT department. And the brighter radio groups have recognised this. And now they've single IT departments who might be supporting a sales database one day and a broadcast playout system the next. They'll probably have some RF engineers on staff or on contract, but IT is now a function across the company. And in my experience, and I've seen this now in a number of different radio groups, having one team rather than two has been a tremendous step for efficiency and new ways of thinking. So if you've an engineering department and an IT department, perhaps it's worth rethinking that. I recommend merging Big T and Little T, because good things happen when people work together.
Every link in the business chain dependent on the strength of its communications tie with every other link.
You can get my weekly newsletter at james.crid.land and daily podcast news at podnews.net. And until next time, keep listening. Now on the Radio Today programme, here's David Lloyd.
When it comes to breakfast presenters, one who dominated early commercial radio history was Les Ross. He's 70 this week.
8 in the morning, and for those who are interested, Michael Aspel was hosting the Sony Radio Awards yesterday, and not as light-hearted as I've seen him. I don't know, I haven't been reading the papers lately, but apparently he's got a problem. Terry Wogan obviously had been reading the papers, which is why when he went on the stage to get his award, Terry Wogan won an award. Well, there's a thought. I think if I remember rightly, he said, because Michael Aspel looked a bit like, well, he'd lost a bit of weight, really. And couldn't figure out why. But anyway, Terry Wogan said, the worst's over now, Michael. You can start putting weight on again. Terry, still, if Michael Aspel will put himself out there. He tried very hard to kind of, like, diffuse the whole thing. When he first came on stage, he said, good heavens, he said, I've never had my photograph taken so often. I can't think why. And then he did the line about, you can only take a photo of a man taking his dog for a walk so many times.
I remember saying to managing director of BRMB, and he called me down one day, something he'd heard. He'd been listening to me driving in. So he said, oh, you know, the way you did this or said that or whatever. I can't remember what it was now. I remember thinking, first of all, it isn't as terrible as you think. And secondly, I remember saying to him, David Pinnell was his name, and he was perfectly good to me, but he was in another world. he probably was more of a BBC fit, really, like a lot of those, especially early commercial radio people, probably were. I remember saying, David, I said, so you were listening to me this morning? And he said, yeah. I said, well, I know. I said, I couldn't tell you who a typical listener is because we're all so different. But I remember this is when I'd started to analyse, especially in commercial radio, about, you know, who you're broadcasting to, what you're doing and who you're doing it for. You've got to have some focus, obviously. I just remember saying, I tell you what, I'm not doing it for you. Why don't you just listen to Radio 4 like you probably want to?
Happy birthday, Les Ross. 26 years on Breakfast in Birmingham on BRMB and Extra. BBC Local Radio mid-evening networking has ceased for now. And it was this week, 2 years ago, that the chap who kicked it off hosted his final edition.
Foundation's head and Build Me Up, Buttercup. Well, I hope you've enjoyed the bits and pieces we've found to replay for you over the past 3 hours. This is the last time I'll be with you on this show, so before I go, could I say thank you for your company over the past 4 years. It's been an absolute joy for me to be here, listening to so many interesting stories and chatting to you on the air and reading the many hundreds of texts and tweets and emails and Facebook posts that you've sent me. And you know what? Even if you've never been in touch but tuned in at some point over the last few years, stopped to listen, maybe been annoyed or inspired or laughed or cried, then we certainly achieved what we set out to do. So, big thank you for being there. It's meant a lot to me. And I'll see you soon, somewhere new, on the BBC.
Mark Forrest. The origins of the UK radio phone-in are a little bit blurred. More than one station claims to have aired the first ever, not least BBC Radio Nottingham, 51 years ago this week.
I see. Well, thank you very much for ringing in, Colin, and sorry you didn't get the right answer, but maybe better luck next week. Thank you, Colin. Bye-bye.
Sure.
Well, well, well. And the telephone is going again, so without further ado, I'll pick it up and see who's on the line this time. Hello.
An early phone-in on Radio Nottingham. Now, whether it was them or not, let's seize this excuse to celebrate the phone-in.
Next call, then, at the time 15 minutes past three, is from Mr. Savage. Hello,
Mr. Savage. Hello, Happy Savage. I'm wondering if any of your listeners in this area could help me.
What's your problem?
At the moment, I am stuck under a wardrobe on the staircase.
You're not.
Yes, the wardrobe has got four hooks on it, and the hooks have got onto the banister, and I just can't move.
How can you get to the telephone?
Well, we've a long extension, and my wife handed it up to me.
I see, and your wife... I'm sorry, Mr. Savage.
She can't help me.
Yeah, it sounds like a very funny situation, doesn't it? But it isn't. Is it hurting you at all?
No, it's not. Actually, if I move, I'm scared the whole wardrobe flies down the stairs.
Right, OK. Whereabouts do you live there, Mr. Savage?
123 Derbyshire Lane.
Derbyshire Lane?
Yeah.
And where's that?
In Sheffield 8.
Is it very heavy, Mr. Savage?
No, I'm able to move it myself, but it's just the position I've got myself in there. I can't do a thing about it.
The Masson time, 6 minutes past 11. Good morning, Terry. Would you go ahead, please?
Good morning, David. Yes, I have a grumble. Yesterday morning, you had on the phone one of the single-parent families asking for jumble. I phoned the number immediately afterwards, asked when they could collect jumble, and they said they asked my address. I told them. They said they would come round last night. So I gave up an hour of an important job I was doing to turn out clothes, books, magazines, littered the place with them, and nobody came.
Yes, this is the sort of thing that I loathe hearing, honey, but we do hear it from time to time, so all I can hope is that the girl who called and who sounded melancholy because she hadn't got much response before is listening now and has made a note of your number and will call you and say, I'm terribly sorry about this, we'll be round in half an hour or at 3 o'clock this afternoon or whenever.
Yes, well, I just thought I'd tell you because, you know, it's very aggravating when you give up. I was doing a particularly important job and I thought, heavens, poor souls, you know.
Yes, and you were kind enough to go to that trouble and you were let down, weren't
you? Yes, exactly. I mean, I was asked out for a drink last evening, you know, Halloween, and I didn't go. I thought, no, I must stay in for these people. I've done this now, you know.
OK, we're going to play you a new record by Metropolis. Ever heard of Metropolis, Maureen?
No.
No, how about you, Ray?
No, I don't think so.
You said you were going to sell them at a fair price. You no need to take no disagreement because his head's in the clouds like yours are.
Here he is.
We never said we were going to sell them at a fair price. We said we'd sell them at the market price, which was dictated to us by the national government.
Wait a minute. A sitting tenant price is not...
You wait a minute. I'm answering what you've just asked me.
All right, just let's sort this one out. Carry on, Mr. Guest, for another minute.
Well, I'll carry on for half a second, I'm off, because it's to have to talk to. Good night and thank you.
Mr. Guest, before you...
I see. The first question is on the phone. It's Mr. Roy Chester.
Good morning. Who's speaking? Chester. Oh, good morning, sir.
Hello, Mr. Chester. Would you like to put...
I don't think we're on yet. No, I don't think we are.
Yes, you are on. Oh, yes, you are.
Good morning.
So, Mr. Chester...
Isn't it beautiful out here just now?
Mr. Chester... Mr. Chester, would you like to put your question, please?
It's crystal clear.
Mr. Chester, are you there?
I'm sunning myself.
Happy 51st anniversary, maybe, to the British phone-in. Commercial radio these days is pretty well consolidated, with a little more still expected. It's 30 years this week since Transworld, the owners of Red Rose Radio in Preston, were bidding.
The update at 2 o'clock, I'm Joanna Hartley. It seems likely that Lancashire millionaire Owen Oyston's won his £39 million takeover bid for the Piccadilly Radio Group. His Miss World group seems certain to take over Piccadilly after the radio station's shareholders voted narrowly to reject a planned merger between Piccadilly and two stations in the Midlands. After gaining victory by less than 1% of the votes cast, Mr. Royston says he's looking forward to working with Piccadilly management and staff.
I hope that we can put plans forward to present the North West as a very, very exciting opportunity for advertisers.
Acquisitions this week in 89, and the full story of that one would take half an hour and some court case notes to tell. The group, of course, eventually became EMAP Radio and now part of Bauer. So with Ian Lee protesting about radio style guides 2 years ago...
Always say, then in bold letters,
all the biggest hits all day long at the top of the link. Then in bold letters, never the end.
Cool FM launching in Northern Ireland 29 years ago.
Good morning and welcome to Cool FM, the new music radio service from Downtown Radio.
The first Pips on air 95 years ago.
Greenwich Mean Time is a historical thing. It's based on astronomical observations. In historical terms, UTC is scientifically produced.
Wyvern splitting frequencies 23 years ago.
It took me 2 weeks to sort out the guests for today and they both cancelled on Friday.
The death of Radio 3's Patricia Hughes 6 years ago.
Good morning, everyone. It's Patricia Hughes in London.
And the announcement of the winners of those very first London radio franchises from the 13 applicants 46 years ago. Those are this week's Radio Moments.
Thank you, David. Check out, by the way, the latest edition of David's Conversations podcast to hear the excellent storytelling from Tommy Boyd about his eventful radio career. Really worth an hour of your time, is that. Thanks also then this week to James Cridland and Trevor Dan and all his guests. Next time, provided no other earth-shattering news before then, we'll have a deeper look into what Bauer's purchase of Lynx and Celador could mean for the commercial radio sector. And we'll probably talk about the Q4 2018 Radar figures as well. See you then.
The Radio Today programme with Broadcast Bionics, creating and distributing clever software for radio.